Hey, Shanao. Good morning, Tony.
Good morning, John. What are people saying? That humans are the most destructive? If people don't like humans, they should go somewhere else. That's what I'm saying.
Find another planet.
That's right.
Peter in Mornington. Good morning, Peter.
Morning, John. John, I was talking, listening to Dick Smith there, talking about feeding ourselves, you know, with the population growth.
Yep.
But I heard on the ABC yesterday, and I wasn't sure whether it was on landline or not, but McCain's Foods are pulling out of Tasmania all our potato growers
yes.
and moving over to New Zealand. Now, how are we going to feed ourselves if all these multinationals and that are just pulling out? You know, where are the growers going to sell their food to give to us?
Well, I don't think McCain's the only people who can get a potato from farmer to market, are they?
Well, I'm not sure, but they must buy a fair amount of potatoes from Tasmania. McDonald's did it ages ago.
Yeah, I'm not panicked by that, Peter.
They're going to do it.
Look, I don't. McCain's will make a business decision based on what they think's best for them. That's not necessarily the same as what's best for everybody else, of course. And I think the potato growers, you know, they may be, and they've often said so when we've spoken to people. A lot of dairy farmers say the big dairies are a bunch of bullies and try and control them, and they may be better off without a big corporation like that trying to tell them how to run their farms.
It was just another one of the multinational sort of thing, I feel, that are just sort of doing what they want to do and not worrying about our growers, which are the most important, basically the most important primary industries in Australia.
Well, I'm not about to panic. Are you?
No.
No. All right. Tony, are you?
I'm panicking, absolutely. McCain's have done it again. Whatever it is, they've done it again.
Yeah, that's their slogan, isn't it?
They're moving to New Zealand. They want things to be smaller and more convenient at all times.
And get the... No, I was going to make jokes about the potatoes and I won't. Frank in Geelong. Morning, Frank.
Good morning. I'd like to talk about the one-day cricket. Somebody I was talking to the other day thought that Kerry Packer had invented one-day cricket.
Yes.
Back in the 50s, the early 50s, I used to work for a large engineering firm in Huddersfield in the UK. And we used to play an interdepartmental 20-over match.
Yes.
Where everyone in the team bought two overs except the wicketkeeper.
Yeah.
And if you got to 50, you had to retire.
Yeah, yeah, we used to do that at school too.
Yeah, which meant that no player, if you had a star bowler or a star batsman, they couldn't completely dominate the game.
And That's right. And Frank, did you pick two captains and then everyone else lined up against the chain wire fence and got picked one after the other for whichever team they're on?
Not quite like that, no.
And if you couldn't bat and you couldn't bowl, you were the last one left standing there and you got
really
embarrassed?
Well, that was the way it was, yeah.
Tony Martin would know that, wouldn't you?
Frank, I know nothing about this game, but Frank, can I ask, is that a Huddersfield accent we're hearing?
It is indeed, yes.
That's a great... I used to work with a bloke like you and he described everything as either smashing or knockout.
Exactly.
Can you give us those for a moment?
Smashing and knockout, I can indeed.
That sounds great. Everything sounds great in that accent.
Oh, you've gone back in a complete spin, haven't you?
Sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm spoiling the program.
Were you left standing on the chain wire fence as one of the last to get picked for the lunchtime cricket game?
I was hiding in the kiln in the art room during all of phys ed throughout high school.
Until someone turned it on.
That's right. Very dangerous.
Text message, went to the tennis last Thursday, day session, got 7.5 hours of tennis, 3 games, 2 men's and a ladies, had a great day, it's just the luck of the draw. Was recently behind a car, had a sticker on it that said, F off, we're full. And then saw a teenager in a shopping centre with a T-shirt on that said, do I look like I effing care? Why is this allowed? Good question. All colonies at independence have the choice of forming a socialist state or changing the flag and leaving the bourgeois in charge. It's not bad. Women's tennis is not value for money. How can women expect to play first up in the evening? They have equal prize money for less time. Women and men run the same marathon distance, compete the same times in sports like hockey. Why not the best of five for women as well as men? We're shortchanged by the women's game, says
obviously,
John from Caulfield South.
The answer is just get a sticker that says, I hate effing women's tennis. And then, you know, sublimate all these feelings into a bumper sticker, I say.
John in Pascoe Vale. Geoffrey Rush joining us with Tony Martin after 11 o'clock for the Conversation Hour. Go ahead, John.
Good morning, John. Regarding the comment about the rails being a bit domed and not fitting the wheels and this back like a ball tyre.
Yeah, surface area.
This is ridiculous. They're dealing with two rigid materials and a train and a wheel. They are subject to what's called Coulomb friction, which is what you're taught in physics in school.
Yep.
The resistance is independent of the area.
Okay.
It's dependent on the coefficient of friction, which is constant. Now, if you get very high, very little contact, those rules break down and you actually get better adhesion because there's local deformation of the rail, you'd get better braking.
This is why we need engineers and physicists.
Yeah, the ball tyre business.
Yeah. I'm afraid I'm going to have to leave the rest of the explanation, but I'm grateful to you for what we've learned already and thank you for your call on the open line.
The Conversation Hour with John Fain on 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
11:05, yes, welcome to today's Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne, ABC Victoria Digital Radio and the World Wide Web. I'm John Fain. My co-host today is either Geoffrey Rush or Tony Martin, and whichever one isn't the co-host can be the guest. Good morning to you both.
Morning.
Tony Martin, Geoffrey Rush, good morning and welcome to the studio.
Thank you.
Happy New Year.
Thank you. 2010. It's taken over, 2010. It's been called that.
It's a beauty. Here's something new that's happened in 2010. I received a letter that had a stamp of Geoffrey Rush on it. You're aware of this? It hasn't happened?
Yes, I am aware.
Do you know
what I find funny about 2010? Do you remember there was a film back in 85 called 2010?
Was there?
It was the sequel to 2001.
Not a particularly
great film, I don't think.
A Peter Hyams film, I think.
Yes, Helen Mirren and Roy Scheider, and it was called The Year We Make Contact.
And what was the premise? Because...
oh, they were out on a moon of Jupiter or something and they made contact with an alien civilization.
Well, we've missed the prerequisite.
That's what we live in.
We've missed the prerequisite because we're not on a Jupiter moon or anything, are we?
Well, indeed. And then, you know, I thought Blade Runner was set in 2019.
Really?
That's only like two elections away, you know?
We've already overtaken Space 1999. That was very futuristic when I was a kid.
Do you remember Lost in Space? They took off. The Robinson family took off. And I don't know why I remember this bit of junk. 16th of October 1997. But when you were a high school student in 1966, that seemed like
a long way away.
That was the Jetsons.
Yeah. You know?
And 1984. The book, and then the film.
Old hat now, isn't
yeah,
it? You know?
Yeah, although, sadly,
it ended up becoming a reality TV show.
There's one called 2012 out. They've gone in too early, I think. It should have been 3012, surely.
2 years.
It's going to look really very daggy at the video shot very quickly. Unless, of course, obviously buildings start falling over. Then they'll have the last laugh.
But there is an undercurrent to all of this, which is that despite people's predictions, expectations, and usually pessimism, things don't turn out the way almost anybody expects, do they?
No.
No, that's what Space 1999 just predicted, skivvies. Everyone in skivvies.
That's only the Wiggles.
That's right. Hasn't happened.
Well, they got that bit right. there was Metropolis, which was set in 2026 when it was made in 1926.
Right.
But it still had Zeppelins and very early planes with about five vertical sets of wings. Mm-hmm. You know that look?
Yeah, that could still happen.
Well, the Zeppelins, the blimps are back, aren't they, every year? I'd love to go for a ride in one of those things. Don't you think it would be an elegant way to travel?
Sure.
Did you ever see the internal shots of the
Not after seeing the Hindenburg.
Yeah, they get a bad press, the blimp.
No, it's not good.
They had luxurious fit-outs. They were like lounge rooms in the sky.
There's just no blimp films with a happy ending. It's a hard sell.
And the other ones were flying boats. They were kitted out like a sort of a lounge or a club, a private club.
Yes, well, I suppose they were trying to emulate the golden age of sea travel.
Yeah.
But because people were getting up in the air around the teens and the 20s.
That's right.
They wanted to create that, you know, crossing the Atlantic kind of jet set, Zeppelin set. They never said that, did they?
The Zeppelin set. The jet pack is the one I'm with. That was the most amazing thing when I was a kid.
The one that you strap on your back.
That's right. That was great.
Yeah.
Has that ever happened, or is it just always held up by wires?
No, it's a guy at the show.
One of those science programs I saw that someone had developed. I just always thought you'd scorch the back of your car.
There was a guy at the show doing it, sort of leaping from one side of the showgrounds to the other.
Right.
It was spectacular.
James Bond had one in You Only Live Twice.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember as a kid, you're going, you can see the wires. The wires are there. Here's something that's interesting that's happened in movies. Do you have Blu-ray at your house, Geoffrey?
No, I don't want to not get sent a Blu-ray player for free. But
right.
This is the ABC.
I find that Blu-ray makes everything look like old, early colour television.
So it's too sharp? Is
too
that what
sharp.
It is?
It makes all of the texture of the screen image look like it's an outdoor broadcast
right, like
sports TV camera.
Right.
You know what I mean? And so you lose some of
the filmic
texture
quality
and the warmth or something.
Well, yeah. I think what they're doing is, I read that with old films, they're using a computer to take the grain out, and then it doesn't look like an old film, so they're having to put more grain back in.
Ah.
But what's happening, what I was reading with regard to wires is, they've got The Wizard of Oz, and they've done a shined-up version of that for Blu-ray, and of course you can see the wires holding the flying monkeys up, which you couldn't even see at the cinemas. But Blu-ray is so sharp, you can see that. So now they're removing the wires digitally, and the argument arises, is that tampering with a work of art? Is that adding something to a famous painting? Mm.
Well, my belief, I mean, that whole colorization scam that started about 20 years ago, where, you know, they started having the technology to colorize old black and white films, and I thought that was intrinsically wrong.
That sort of didn't last. That sort of went the way of the Macarena, though, didn't it? It didn't catch on. Then it disappeared.
Well, I think it was a promotional thing, because they had all those, you know, cable networks had bought up all of the old MGM repertoire, and whatever was in black and white, they thought, well, people aren't going to want to watch this.
No. But you do. But
so
you
it's
do.
A cheap way of whizzing it out there. But if you look at great black and white photography, you know, whether it's, you think of Kubrick's Lolita in black and white.
Yes.
It's you don't want that to become
colorized,
you know.
And it's the integrity of the works, the creative's right, the creative author's right to maintain the integrity of it, that's at stake here too, isn't it? How should someone else be making that decision rather than the person who first did? It's their
call. Or if you do some kind of artistic appropriation. I don't know if you saw the Peter Greenaway, Leonardo's Last Supper. I mean, I found that just extraordinary experience. It was only 20 minutes long. He'd recreated the fresco at, I think, life-size.
At North Melbourne Town Hall. Yep.
Yeah. And then played with various, you know, with various lighting states. I don't know how, it was computer-generated to music, where he would only light the hands in the painting, and you suddenly became aware, it was like a great art lesson, you became aware of the beautiful harmony and balance and symmetry that was sort of so subtly placed within the painting.
Right.
It was fantastic.
Mm. But he wasn't altering, he was just interpreting with the lights.
He was giving you a high art audio-visual tutorial.
Yeah, right. Which is a wonderful thing. I've got lots of text messages. Thunderbirds was set in...
Was that in the future?
2026, says Matthew.
I guess it was futuristic.
Back to the Future?
Yeah.
Back to the Future. Future was 2015. Where are those flying DeLoreans and hoverboards?
Yes, indeed.
And
that'll be a 2015 Christmas stocking.
Yeah, hoverboard. Bring that on.
Yeah.
Hoverboard accidents will be regularly reported. There will be no way of regulating them.
What are those two-wheel things that are electric with gyroscopes in them? Segways.
Yeah.
Segways. They looked science fiction when they came out, didn't they? It must be 10 years ago.
Have you got one of those?
No. I've had a ride.
Really?
I've had a play. It takes about 5 minutes to work it out, and then you just want one. That's all. You just want one.
I just associate them with Will Arnett's character on Arrested Development, and I think just anyone now reminds me of him, i.e. an idiot, if I see one on them.
No, they're fabulous. They're great fun, and they seem terribly practical, but there's some standoff between the regulators here, like the Vic Roads type registration thing. And
I did see those people movers, you know, those sort of circular plinths that you stood on and it had a vertical bar that you'd hang on to, and if you leant forward, it would move you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how they worked. I saw some, like, in a park in Paris a couple of years ago.
With
I saw
wheels?
A group of people
who
looked like German tourists. You know, there was a clutch of them moving around the Bois de Boulogne or something on these people movies.
No horse involved?
No. I don't know how they worked. It had something to do with you had to just slightly lean forward and your body weight would create enough momentum to get you at walking speed.
What's wrong with just walking, I say? Bring that back.
Atrophied legs. We'll all end up like Sam Worthington in Avatar.
Right.
One gammy leg. Yeah, that's probably what happened, is people mover.
What did you think of Avatar, Jeffrey?
I found, it's one of those phenomenon films. The technology in it is overwhelming and extraordinary. I was a little disappointed in the nature of the depth of the storytelling. I found at the beginning I thought they might have had a 3.5-hour rough cut of that film.
Right.
With a lot of very intense, you know, like a big Victor Hugo novel that you read for, you know, a couple of days to, before you got into the world of Pandora.
Yes.
Because when they went there and I thought, well, there are blue people lying in warm, shallow baths and then your brain is going to be put into them. Why?
Hmm.
And it seemed like a mining company story, you know, raping a kind of distant moon.
Hmm.
So all those threads I found a bit tricky to get into. And then I thought, you know, I think John Ford in The Searchers did it better in terms of crossing a line between what an imperial culture does to a colony. To me, it ended up being a little bit of an old-fashioned cowboys and Indians movie.
Well, that's what it ends
but
up.
I got the bang for my buck.
Yeah,
I mean,
and
you know, whatever I paid $16 to get in, I just went. The visuals in this are absolutely groundbreaking, landmark. You know,
3D. You saw it in?
Oh yeah.
Did you flinch as things came at you?
Yeah, I did.
And as soon as you do that, you go, oh, "This is good."
They're getting very good at that now.
It's incredible. Mean,
The 3D used to be very show-offy, and also there's something about the 2D language of film where we've built up this familiar syntax of, you know, wide shots and over-the-shoulder shots and everything. When you do that in 3D, it's like you're whipping the space around.
Yes.
It gets a bit kind of nauseating, but they seem to be... I think Ice Age 3 is the one that really found the style.
Well,
Sid Sloth was absolutely brilliant in 3D.
Right. Because I think I've mentioned this before on this show, John, but when I was a kid, there was House of Wax with Vincent Price. But when it was shown on TV, there is, I think, a two-minute sequence where a bloke outside the House of Wax has a ping-pong bat with a ball attached and just bats it at the camera. Must have looked amazing in the cinemas in 1953. Completely baffling on the late-night film, Channel 7. What's this?
Makes no sense at all.
Experimental cinema.
But when Geoffrey Rush goes to the movies, can you see it as a spectator, as an ordinary patron, or are you analysing the filmmaking process as well?
I think if I get roped into the imaginative world of the film, I never think of the technique until afterwards, and I go, wow, how'd they achieve that? Or how complex and subtle and sophisticated was that storytelling? Because it absolutely had me engrossed. If it doesn't do that, then I probably do sit back and go, I'm aware now of the camera pushing in, presumably for some kind of intensifying emotional effect, but all I can sense is the guys laying down the tracks and the director thinking, this will be good, you know, rather than what's happening within the frame being exciting.
What's it like when you watch those Pirates films for the first time? I mean, I'm assuming it must be mystifying
it's
when
like,
you're on the
it's
set.
It's like seeing your old home movies of the holiday you went on.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
But with a lot more octopuses.
Well, yeah, that's right. Bigger sort of calamari monsters and things. Because that film didn't really... The first film didn't really have that many obvious special effects. There were a lot. I mean, I think there are many more CGI effects in most films that people are completely unaware of. But that was probably the last of the big studio endeavours. This was back in 2002 we were shooting, where we actually went to sea on giant boats and had real sea in the background and whatever. You know what I mean? And by the time we got to the third film where there was a massive maelstrom, we were surrounded by green screen and the computers did all of them. You know, Davy Jones. Poor old Bill Nye turned up on set. We were all in full costumes, beards, heavy, gnarled skin, big hats, monkey, all that sort of stuff. Bill Nye came out in a pair of grey silk pyjamas with a little sort of ABC test card pattern from the 60s around his head, this mottled effect like a chessboard, so the camera and the computer could pick up all of his head movements and then put in all of the, you know, the giant mask of squid-like beard that he had and stuff. So he looked like he was in a Robert Lepage Melbourne Festival avant-garde theatre work, and we were up there, you know, doing just an old Errol Flynn movie.
But trying to keep a straight face.
Pretty much.
I'm still trying to remember. You were killed at the end of the first one.
I was.
How did you come... What was the...
I suppose it was in parts two and three, the writers were very keen to not just franchise out the same storyline. So they went into a sort of Wagnerian dimension of having sea gods and goddesses and the Kraken. You know, the great mythology of this golden era of sailing was that, you know, these films were still set, you know, only 100 or so years after people thought they'd go off the end of the world if you went too far. So they incorporated all of that. And the Tia Dalma character, through her kind of Louisiana-style voodoo, brought me back to life because
she knew that
I was one of the nine pirate lords who had a vote to free her from being under the spell of Davy Jones. It's very complex.
It certainly is.
Perfectly logical.
I'm waiting for the first PhDs to be written on the narrative structure of the Pirates trilogy.
Is there a fourth? There is talk of a fourth
there
one.
There is talk. Oh, no, it's definitely happening.
Right.
And I think it's... they're very conscious of making it a kind of return to the roots of what made the first film pop in people's imaginations. I don't think they're, you know, I mean, these films, anything that makes over, you know, $500 million or $1 billion, Disney doesn't say, well, that was a wonderful creative endeavor. No. Let's put it to bed and leave it at that. They go, do you think we can squeeze any more out of the market?
Right.
But the two writers, Ted Elliott and Terry Rossio, are very bright boys. And they are following through the little teaser that came at the end of the third film, which is about a hunt for the Fountain of Youth.
I love it when a movie, this used to be a common thing when I was a kid, a movie would end and it would say, there's another one coming. And I was watching recently the Matt Helm films with Dean Martin. Got all four of them on DVD. And at the end of every one will say, that's the end of the ambushes. A couple of years from now, The Wrecking Crew. Then The Wrecking Crew was the last one. And at the end it says, Matt Helm will return in The Ravages. And he never did. He never did return. But there's the logo for it there. You're going, someone must have written a script. It was going to happen. What, did Dean just crack it? That's enough. I can't drink any more martinis.
Some studio boss was taken out and executed and never finished the vision.
Oh, I love it. I just think, you know, it would be good to have, you know, at the end of a film, you know, the reader will return in, bring that format back.
Well, it's Dickens, isn't it? I mean, he just kept writing the books.
Well, he's serialised. His stories were published in magazines week by week.
I think he got a lot of flack if he killed off a character that became terribly popular. The death of Little Nell, what's that in? The old Curiosity Shop.
Never read it.
He got a lot of flack for that.
Did he?
Yeah, it's a bit like Home and Away, you know, someone gets killed wrongly or...
Sorry, did you...
They get a makeup.
Jeffrey Rush just said that Dickens is like Home and Away. Can we play that on a sort of archival, you know, put it in something special? I can't believe I just heard that.
But is it... Did he start... So they're publishing it before he knows how it ends. Is that what you're saying?
No, he's publishing it. I think that was for the majority of the works.
Dickens,
he wrote for whatever the magazine was.
Dickens had, it was called The Gazette, I think, or something.
Yeah.
And he'd thumb it out, but he'd fill in the gaps as he wrote, and often there's a fabulous exhibition at his old home, which is in Bloomsbury in London, and you can go and clamber around and go into Dickens' kitchen and scullery and all the rest of it, and they have manuscripts and letters and samples and everything. There's a bit of scandal about Dickens. Did you know he left his wife after they had 10 children?
Really?
And had an affair with a young actress.
Yes, I saw that dramatised documentary.
Shocking breed you lot, aren't you?
And he managed to maintain the affair for quite some time through the British Rail system, which was quite new at the time. He could catch trains and he'd go, well, I'll get the 10:40 from Euston to, you know, Cheshire or something, and then I'll join up with the one going west to wherever.
Right.
And that's how he ran the
And there was nobody, there was no paparazzi with a giant camera.
Well, there was, because he was such a celebrity at the time.
He was sprung, wasn't he? Because there was an
spotted.
Accident.
Yeah.
One of the trains went off the rails or something, and he was on it.
Well, he wrote about the train crash, and then people wanted to know what he was doing. Why was he there?
Of course. Yeah.
But, you know, you kind of think of him as some moral compass, and in fact he might have been a bit of a cad. I think his daughter wrote a book about him after he died, didn't she? Sort of a tell-all and the housekeeper
what the
or something.
Dickens.
Probably. Something like that. Is it true? This is a story you often hear associated with the theatre, Jeffrey. Maybe you can tell me if this is true. The story about the person, the reviewer, who didn't go and see the play and wrote a scathing review of the play, and then it turned out the theatre had burnt down and the performance had never gone ahead. I've heard that one a few times.
I tend not to file away anecdotes about critics.
Really?
I just have a difficult relationship with what they are,
right.
I suppose. I mean, there have been, at various points in history, golden ages of theatre criticism. Mm. When I was at university, I found this fantastic book called Victorian Theatre Criticism. I was that kind of teenager.
Right.
And it's a collection of essays written from the early 19th century to the late 19th century. So it starts off with people like Leigh Hunt, who I sort of vaguely knew as a poet. And it goes right through to George Bernard Shaw, most certainly, writing the most fantastic accounts of where and why and how various now notable productions of great literary acknowledged works first presented themselves. And there's one essay that I think it's Shaw that writes. He describes Dan Leno, who was a very famous music hall artist, very famous for his Panto Dame.
Right.
And it's like being there, and you think that's part of what fantastic criticism is about, is that it's also a bit like a time capsule. Hmm. That we don't, you know, I doubt that there's any recording. Dan Leno would have died in 1904 or something. Right. But he was like the Tommy Cooper or the Barry Humphreys or the, you know, the Steve Martin or whatever of that time. And he just describes how he would go back week by week to see the performance and how much it had grown and developed over the course of working it in with an audience.
Right.
It's just highly, highly evocative.
Well, I would say that there's rock criticism that's written that well now.
Sure.
If you think of that bloke who was portrayed in Almost Famous.
Oh.
What was his name?
Yes,
Philip Seymour Hoffman played him. I always forget his name.
Lester Bangs. Yeah.
I was reading his liner notes for the Gitche Yayas out Rolling Stones album, and that had that sort of feel to it.
Yeah.
He was comparing the studio version to the live version.
Yeah.
So there is that kind of writing, but are you saying that theatre criticism, you don't get that sort of thing anymore?
Look, in Australia, I think we're not in a golden age for that sort of writing. There are a few blogs around now that come up with more than just a, you know, I liked it. No, I didn't like it. Kind of
sucks. Just adding the word sucks to the end of the title.
Essay, you know.
Don't.
Right. Yeah.
But hang on, you are getting very good reviews for The Drowsy Chaperone.
The Drowsy Chaperone, in fact, has...
They have been very, very positive, and you know, they, to be honest, I think that they're reflecting what the spirit of the each performance is like and how the house is responding.
Right.
I mean, there's nothing more annoying when you have, you know, audiences giving you roars of approval.
Yes.
I mean, we can sniff out on stage when that's genuine and when it's not. Or if an audience goes suddenly passive on you, you think, we've got a bit of a dull spot here.
Right.
There have been too many times in my career where I thought, if they'd just at least honestly said that the house went wild, even though I didn't like
it. That's right. Well, that's the thing with comedy. You can be doing a show and you feel like 200 people are laughing, and then the review says, well, I didn't find any of it amusing whatsoever. It does feel like there should be an asterisk going, but yes, everyone else seemed to be getting into it.
Mm.
Give us the basic premise, The Drowsy Chaperone, which is, of all things for the MTC, a musical, but almost anti-musical musical.
Well, the MTC, I suppose, as a state company, has a history of... I wouldn't say they do a musical every year, but within their repertoire in the last 10 or 12 years, there have been maybe more of the chamber scale of works, like... They've done Company by Sondheim. They've done Little Night Music at some point. They did Urinetown. They did the Spelling Bee, Putnam Spelling Bee one. Works that probably came more from an off-Broadway scale and ended up on Broadway, because the resources of that kind of company with a six-week season means that they can't really do Wicked, where you've got to have 40 people. You know what I mean? So The Drowsy Chaperone fits into that model. It's for me, it's a huge cast, because, you know, I'm normally in a play with three other people.
Right.
That's pretty standard in the diminishing of, you know, the kind of funds that people can spend on this within this so-called subsidized arena. So having 16 amazing people in the company and a band of eight, alongside a massive stage management and stage crew, and we've had secondments from NIDA and the VCA and as assistant directors. So walking into a rehearsal room with 30 people has been really quite spectacular. And the gamble has paid off, because I think they've probably, I don't know, I don't do the production side, but, you know, I think we have to do like 95% good business to break even. It's not a profit-orientated venture.
But it's going gangbusters.
It's going gangbusters, and I would love to think that it could do a commercial transfer, because, you know, something like somewhere like the National Theatre or the Lincoln Center in America, they might do something homegrown on their, you know, home stage, and then they, if they find they've got a hit on their hands, they throw it into the West End and it runs for 6 or 9 months, and that's better than going around cap in hand to corporate sponsorship and having to have all of those slightly tedious after-show drink parties. Snoozing.
And congratulations also on Brand New Day, which we should mention before we bring our other guest into the conversation now today. Brand New Day is the first Indigenous musical. It's the stage show put to the screen, yes, in which Geoffrey Rush plays a, I think he's a Lutheran minister, is he?
He's a German missionary, yeah. Catholic. They were around way back, I think the 1840s. They started coming out, and they went into remote parts of Western Australia. So that tradition's been there for a very long time. So Jimmy Chai, who wrote the piece, I think it's pretty semi-autobiographical about his youth in the 60s of being sent off to Clontarf down in Perth, because becoming a priest was sort of the best way out of growing up in Broome at that time. And the musical charts his desire to get back to Broome.
A road trip.
It is. It's a kind of a musical road movie. It just opened in Sundance. We were invited into the section that's not in competition because it's already played elsewhere in the world. And I was just reading a review online this morning, raving about it. It was quite good to hear an external view away from the, you know, all of the various baggages that local commentary might put onto this kind of film.
It's a fantastic assembly of
And they describe it as Grease meets Ten Canoes, which I thought was pretty damn good.
Dan Salt and Jessica Moorboy, a couple of not well-known locals.
Missy Higgins,
Magda Zabanski.
Young boy Rocky McKenzie, who is the household name of Broome.
Ernie Dingo, stealing the film.
One of the great performances, yeah, I think.
And the Pigram Brothers with music. Lots of fabulous things. So look out for Brand New Day. But the Drowsy Chaperone selling out fast at the MTC. Now, Rhonda Birchmore, Shane Jacobson, Richard Piper, Robin Nevin, Christy Whelan, I could rattle off the rest of the 15 or 16 people, but Geoffrey Rush, our guest today, to showcase this wonderful, wonderful musical, which starts off telling you that this is a musical for people who don't really like musicals.
Well, I suppose the story centres around a fairly lonely kind of isolated guy who's a complete Broadway freak who lives in his New York apartment. And I suppose you get these hints through the script, because it's the most wonderful book. It's the one thing that none of the critics here have picked up on. The writing of the piece is absolutely fantastic. They tend to think, oh, it's just a spoof of a 1928 musical that I happen to be comparing, or I happen to be kind of narrating. But there's a bounce in the writing between this 21st century, rather ironic, postmodern look at what were all these fluffy musicals of the 20s about, and what is the nature of this guy's obsession with this one show that he's using to escape from reality. So when I read the script for it, I thought, this is like an absurdist piece of writing. This is the Ionesco musical, you know. So there's something in that, and it's got a wonderful sense of wit. And the show literally comes to life in his head, in his own living room. So it is based a little on those experiences some people might have had. Tony, I reckon you might have had this.
Oh, yeah.
If not with MAME, as I did when I was a teenager. Of jumping around your sitting room, listening to something on the stereogram and going, I'm in that.
Absolutely, with the giant headphones on. Sure, I think I was in Deep Purple for a couple of months. I think I was.
You are Ian Gillan.
No, I was Richie Blackmore. I think you'll find.
The Drowsy Chaperone. We're going to play you some of the music from The Drowsy Chaperone, a song that Geoffrey has chosen called Show Off, from The Drowsy Chaperone, which is on at the MTC. It's just opened. The reviews rave about it, and the season's been extended, but can't keep going forever. So if you're interested, be one of those who will get to see it before it sells out completely. And joining us in just a moment, Tony Martin is my co-host, Geoffrey Rush, Academy Tony, Emmy and AFI award-winning actor. Starring in the Melbourne Theatre Company's MTC is our first guest. And joining us in a moment, going back to the days of the Pram Factory, if we want to go that far back, Dr. Alison Richards will tell us about 30 years of Theatre Works' success in Melbourne. And she and Geoffrey Rush can undoubtedly compare notes. But this is from The Drowsy Chaperone. This is the song Show Off. From The Drowsy Chaperone, that's Show Off, selected by Geoffrey Rush. In a moment, we'll meet one of the lyricists of the show and also Dr. Alison Richards, who's here from Theatre Works, who are celebrating 30 years of success on the local theatre scene. Geoffrey Rush, Tony Martin, I'm John Fain. This is The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne, ABC Victoria, the World Wide Web and digital radio as well. It's 20 minutes to 12.
I have three kids and a home to run. I don't have the luxury of falling apart.
Take a melodious journey with the BBC's Heart and Soul.
You must have seen what happened when Layla started to sing.
As recently seen on ABC One, a small town choir, a family and their community are all fractured by the arrival of the beautiful, talented and manipulative soprano Layla.
The choir has so much potential.
Now on DVD and exclusive to ABC Shops, Centres and ABC Shop Online.
20 minutes to 12, you're on The Conversation Hour. Tony Martin's my co-host. Geoffrey Rush was our first guest. Or was Geoffrey Rush the co-host and Tony Martin was our first guest? We're joined now by one of the lyricists from The Drowsy Chaperone. Lisa Lambert is here from...
I'm here from New York, but originally from Toronto, where the show originated.
Because you can make a terrible mistake and call a Canadian American, or sometimes calling an American a Canadian.
I'm both. I feel like a New Yorker and a Torontonian, and it's all cities for me, really.
Tell us the story of The Drowsy Chaperone. How did it come into being?
Oh, well, it started at a bachelor party in Toronto. Bob Martin, who was one of the co-writers, was getting married, and I was his best man. And I felt...
Sorry.
Yes, I know. It's all a bit confusing. I was the best man at his wedding to Janet Vandegraaff, who happens to be, that's the lead character's name in The Drowsy Chaperone. It was my job to create the bachelor party, and I thought, why don't we, since we were all a bunch of comedians and theater people, why don't we put on a show? So we had this title and this concept for a while, and I thought, this is the best time to, why don't we actually attack this and finish it and impress Bob? And it impressed him so much that he came on board as a writer a year later when we did it at the Toronto Fringe Festival, and then it just took off from there. Kept getting picked up and taken to larger venues in Toronto, and New York producers saw it and brought it. It was just a fairy tale.
So the main characters are still called Robert Martin and Janet Vandegraaff. So it'll be like, you know, Tony Martin and...
Mm. And Sid Charisse.
And
yeah, there you go.
Wow, that's...
You can
go
dream.
Further with that?
That's next year.
That's right.
So the incarnation we see now, how different is it to what you started with?
Initially, there's the Jeffrey's character, the man in chair. There was no man in chair in the very first production. It was just a pastiche musical with no comment. And this group of people that I work with, we had done a few shows kind of like this where we had a different kind of narrative device. And when we tried not having one, we thought, no, we need that juxtaposition of modern and fluffy past. And Bob was... just lent himself perfectly to that particular
He's
function.
Great. I mean, yeah. His voice is so much in the writing because he's like a gossip. He's a Tony Martin, really, because he's filled with a lexicon of great pop cultural knowledge.
I'm just seeing. I mean, there's even a physical similarity. You could be channeling each other here.
But does he know about nothing that's of any use?
And Don McKellar, our other book writer, he probably knows even more useless information than Bob, I would say.
Right. See, you haven't reached your prime yet, Tony Martin. You haven't reached your prime. Also joining us, as well as Lisa Lambert and Geoffrey Rush, is Dr. Alison Richards, who's here because it's 30 years this year that we've had the pleasure of Theatre Works on the Melbourne Theatre scene.
Yes, indeed, and it's a funny thing. I'm sure half of us sitting around the table here can't even believe it's been that long.
No.
I mean, I still think of the gang who started Theatre Works as young, enthusiastic, bright-eyed graduates from the VCA.
Absolutely, Alison, absolutely.
Then all of a sudden, here we are, and we've got 30 candles on the cake.
Which is fantastic.
Well, it is fantastic, and congratulations, because there are others that have fallen by the wayside. over those 30 years. I'm not quite sure how you have managed to make sure Theatre Works survives.
Well, it's a rocky road, and it's been a rocky road. Theatre Works has had several incarnations and reincarnations in that 30-year period. Started off as the classic 1970s collective group of a single year graduating from the drama school, the very newly formed drama school.
Which we know is a very efficient way of running anything, a collective.
Well, until people get old, get married, have children, you know, that sort of thing. And there was a time, in fact, when I can remember walking into the theatre and seeing grass growing between the floorboards, and not the sort of grass you think, Tony. But we're now a venue. We get wonderful support from Arts Victoria. And we've managed to put enough coins in the piggy bank over the years so that we're a venue. We look to people in the independent sector, just like you, Lisa. I mean, it's all familiar, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It's the kids are graduating from schools with a whole lot more skills than I know I had when I was the same age.
Mm.
And the ceiling's lowering. They can't get a break. So we're, as an organisation, there to support not the very new ones with the wet behind the ears, but we've managed over the last few years to get to a point where we're targeting people who know what they're doing.
Sure.
And we've got a couple of programs where, with our own money, not with any corporate support or any other help, we're offering a program of support to selected, we call it our Selected Works program. And we've got some terrific stuff coming up this year in that program too. So it's a sort of a mix. We've got the usual oily rag that they're smelling in the corner. We've got a whole 1.625 staff.
1.625
full-time staff, plus the usual assortment of out-of-work actors and various other people who are working front of house and that sort of thing.
Melbourne doesn't realise how lucky it is. I mean, we have got an alternative independent theatre scene here that it would be the envy of most cities of our size in the world.
Mm.
When you think of Theatre Works or Red Stitch or 45 Downstairs or the work that goes on in the Black Box or Chapel Off Chapel, this is a sort of breeding, it's a seething breeding ground.
Mm.
I mean, I know with Drowsy Chaperone, mm-hmm. a lot of our company, I went and saw some of the guys that had auditioned for us, and I wanted to see them live in performance, and I went down to Chapel Off Chapel for a one-off Sunday afternoon. There's a whole world out there that is like, it's not underground.
No, it's a test bed, isn't it?
It's just that it's not kind of given the recognition and the support and the kind of the thrill of having it around us. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Everyone sort of thinks, oh, well, the big blockbuster musicals are on, or there's the MTC and the Malthouse, but there's this whole kind of fantastic subculture out there that actually is absorbing the great graduates that come out of the local training institutions.
Yes, the big difficulty, I think, for a lot of young people making their careers is that there's a big jump between La Mama or working in the local garage or the local shed that you've managed to rig up with a couple of lights and a main stage theatre. Yep. And Theatre Works, because we've got about 200 seats, we're fully rigged, we can offer that kind of middle ground and middle term. So people who have got their shit together, have got their chops, can go in there, can start to build an audience, and can really practice their craft and get to that next stage of being then able to say to a commercial management or to another
or
company
a promoter.
Or pitch.
How important is student theatre, Alison? Because that's part of the work you do too.
Me personally, well, I think student theatre is very important. At the moment, I'm at Monash University, and there's a very active student theatre out there, just as there has been for many years at Melbourne University.
I think everyone at this desk started in student theatre.
Well, I feel I should, as always, fly the flag for my people, the people in amateur theatre. Hello to anyone who's working at Mitre 10 today and then suiting up as Julius Caesar in the evenings, possibly in a production with a meal. I'd just like to, you know, you're on the team as well, guys.
But it is. I mean, that is the reality. And, I mean, how many people... And, Geoffrey, for how many years did you struggle to make a living out of being a professional performer, and how many others have fallen by the wayside in the meantime?
I was lucky that when I was at Queensland Uni, it was a particularly volatile, fertile time for on-campus theatre. And that led me directly into a job with the newly created State Theatre Company. And even at that company, I got a three-year contract. I was doing eight shows a year. I mean, that structure doesn't exist anymore.
Were you with Popular Theatre Troupe at all?
No, I wasn't. They were a lot of my colleagues. That kind of started up around the same time that we were all at university together.
And, of course, Richard Fotheringham is now the Executive Dean of Arts at Queensland University. He started in the Popular Theatre Troupe. So, it got very respectable.
So, Lisa, is this all ringing a bell from the North American experience too?
Absolutely. We have theatres in Toronto, a very similar 200-seat theatre called the Poor Alex Theatre in Toronto, where a lot of our stuff started. Same kind of thing. About maybe 150 seats. We could try stuff out there, experiment. And that's how a lot of the Drowsy Chaperone started at that, a place called the Rivoli, these clubs. Sounds very much like the Toronto scene.
Not wanting to bring current state politics into it, but the liquor licensing laws are a really important part of paying the bills, and this is another aspect of the current our state government here, reforming the liquor laws and making licences more expensive and putting security requirements on if you're selling alcohol. It suddenly makes theatre, as well as music venues, it makes theatre venues marginal and makes it harder to, make a buck out of the bar, which is a really important way of getting money in too.
Well, the licences are all because of violence in the streets.
Yeah,
and
there
does seem to be...
MTC's renowned.
That's right,
for
that's what
brawls.
I'm saying. It's wine and cheese brawls.
Yeah.
Got to shut the place down. I say they did it with the tote, let's shut the theatres down.
Four in the morning out there, brawling...
Well, we're lucky on that count because we're actually the old church hall for the lovely Anglican church in St Kilda. So I suppose if we get any trouble, we'll just call the vicar.
That'd work. Absolutely, absolutely. So where does TheatreWorks go? If you can see where it is in its next 30 years, how do you see it, Alison?
That's a really interesting question. Ideally... my dream would be, like you, Lisa, somebody comes, they say, what a fantastic operation, and how much money would you like? At which point, what we really lack is a circuit at the independent theatre level. People are putting so much effort and energy into getting a show together, and it's on and it's off in 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And often, it's only in the last week that everyone gets around to seeing it. So what we'd really like to do would be to be able to get, I guess, to the next level, to select works from our alumni, because by now we've worked with really a lot of the very good independent theatres in Melbourne, and to be able to present those people to get them an opportunity where they could play in Brisbane or Sydney or New York.
There has to be that link, because I think everyone's sort of been a bit brainwashed into thinking on that commercial level. You know, we were told by the government a couple of years ago, you've got to pay your way. Now, you can't do that unless you're going to run a show for months and months and months and months and months. And more often than not, that means, you paint the depth of experience that you want to create in whatever work of art, whether it's a single stand-up comedy show or a 10-person, obscure drama. You start to paint the work, the experience, very, very thin if you want to reach a mass audience. Mm. And sometimes these shows collect very subcultural, very informed, very highly energetic audiences that want a little bit more meat on the bone, And that you need to have these venues that don't have to actually look for profit margin. They're looking at kind of, just fueling the culture so that it's got this diversity to it.
Mm. With our program of selected works, and we've now got a second tier which is called In the Works for those companies that aren't actually ready to put a production on and need the development time. But with selected works, the magic Potion has actually been offering a publicist. So we've been able to put together a package that allows the companies to put their effort into making the work, which is what they're going to do anyway. It's just that they usually wake up the night before they're about to go on and go, oh, yes, well, we should get a flyer together or something like that.
We need to tell people it's on.
We need to tell people
it's
on.
We put so much effort into getting it ready, yes.
So our Selected Works program offers a package. We put out a season brochure, which I have here in the envelope. Da-da!
Here it comes.
Here it comes, and it's very well designed by famous promotions.
Hold it up for everyone to look at
Hold
on the radio.
Hold it up for everyone to look at on the radio.
Thank you, Alison.
Gorgeous. And, you know, it offers you a calendar, and there's a little bit about each show, and it's just something that allows...
But see, that costs money and takes time and requires expertise, and that's a level of professionalism that not every small theatre group can do.
Do you think with web links the word flyer in about 5 years' time will become something that needs annotated footnotes?
Absolutely. I've used already. Is that on Twitter? Can I get that on Twitter?
Well, you can get it on Facebook.
There you go.
And on our website.
Which is essential. I mean, why not? Why not? As people migrate away from paper. But word of mouth is still surely the most powerful driver of audiences wherever you are. Lisa's nodding
her head. Old-fashioned word of mouth is what the internet's great at, because you can actually get it around to the niche groups to go, this is the party you need to be at.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah.
And word of mouth will kill you if it's no good just as easily as it'll create you if you're terrific. I mean, nothing will save you if you've got a lousy show.
And the other thing is your ears. I mean, I had a lovely experience just while I was waiting to come in here when you were playing the song from The Drowsy Driver. And I was there bopping away in the background, not even realising that this lovely lady here was going,
I was quite thrilled to see the lovely dancing happening and feeling slightly responsible for that. That was great.
So often the very best things happen just out of range of the microphone or even the web camera, I should say, too, as well.
Are we on camera at the moment? Hello to anyone.
Yeah.
I'm twittering this at the moment. I think it's only every 30 seconds. There's a frozen frame, so you've really got to hold that position.
Yeah, you're blocking Jeffrey's line, Tony. Just be careful there.
If you can't see the camera, it can't see you.
That's right. Any official celebrations, Alison?
Yes, indeed. We are having a birthday dinner at Clay Pots, which is a fabulous St Kilda restaurant that does fish and stuff.
But if there's people who are listening who have been at some point over the 30 years on the periphery or even at the very core of Theatre Works, they should jump on.
We want to talk to you. And in fact, Paul Davies, who was part of the original gang way back, is now up at the University of Queensland.
I know Paul from my time at university in Brisbane. Yeah.
And he's back at the University of Queensland doing his PhD on the early years of Theatre Works.
Well, he's writing about himself.
And other people.
He's doing a PhD on himself, what I did when I was young.
You've got to do something with the 40 boxes of stuff you've accumulated in your garage.
Someone else is supposed to study you. Tony Martin, there's an opening for you. You can be a doctor.
I'll do that, and I'll throw in other Tony Martins at no extra charge.
Yes, that's right. Well, that's good. And the jetpack. I want the jetpack.
Sure, don't we all?
But we're putting out a book. There will be a book.
Yeah. Pop-up book? Can we have a pop-up book?
I think it might have, you know, one of those little old-fashioned dioramas.
You pull a string down the bottom and everyone stands up on the page.
I used to have one of those.
Yeah, they are.
So, yeah, anybody who remembers Theatre Works, anybody who ever had a show on in Theatre Works.
Jeffrey, quick, look at the screen. Avatar, 1.84 billion box office to date.
Ah, well, it's just top Titanic.
That was just on Sky News. It just
like
flashed up.
It was 1.83, wasn't it?
What you need at Theatre Works is 3D glasses. Something
where, nine foot blue characters.
Yeah. So that's right.
I guess you'd have to go to 4D in the theatre somehow.
Well, you would. But come on down to Ackland Street, St Kilda. Give us a call. And we really want to hear from you and put everybody into our little book.
And Lisa, how long are you out here for?
I am here for another 2 weeks. And I have to add one thing to add very quickly. Conquest of the Planet of the Apes was set in 1991. I was listening to that out there, and
Conquest of Planet of the Apes.
That's the fifth one.
I've lost.
Yes. It's the fourth one.
Oh, really? Oh, it's before Battle.
It's before
and after Escape.
Yes, you are so correct. And the very opening shot, it says North America, 1991, and then you see an ape running by in some kind of a human uniform. He may even be carrying a briefcase. I'm not sure.
They don't make it like that.
They certainly, there'll be another.
Thank goodness. The TV show UFO was set in 1980, but no moon bases yet, says Rob from East St Kilda. They keep on coming in.
The buffs are listening to your show.
Yeah.
I bet they've still got the monkey suit somewhere.
Alexander Corder, Things to Come, 1936, ended in 2036. Miff Warhurst, good morning to you. Are you a sci-fi enthusiast?
Muzzle Tony out of the way here. Yeah. Sorry.
Are you into those sci-fi films, and have you noticed that the various dates are passing by which their predictions have not come true?
I have noticed that, but I'm with you on the Planet of the Apes thing. I think, you know, it broke new ground there.
Oh.
It's genius. I had a marathon a couple of years ago and sat through the whole lot, and by the time I get to the fifth,
back to back.
Yeah. I think I had chicken pox at the time, so that was the only way I got through it all. But
you would have had glandular fever by the time it finished.
Here's one for you, Tony Martin. What year's Avatar set?
I still haven't seen it.
2154.
Oh, well, who'll be laughing in 2155?
I'll be waiting to
die. Blue people, I waited 50 years, it didn't happen.
We'll be cryovacked or something, won't we?
Right.
Tony Martin, my co-host, Jeffrey Rush, our first guest, Lisa Lambert, who's over here because she wrote the music for The Drowsy Chaperone with other people, and Dr. Alison Richards, chairwoman, I think we call her, of Theatre Works this afternoon, Miff.
I'm filling in for Richard. He's taking that special day that everybody else seems to
He's
be taking
a sickie.
Off. So we're bringing Australia Day one day early today and discussing a whole lot of things about Australia Day, changing Waltzing Matilda.
Yeah.
That's a big one. And we've got
Australians
a performance.
All our ostriches for me.
And we've got some live performances as well, so it's going to be lovely.
Fabulous. Miff Warhurst with you on the radio this afternoon. This has been The Conversation Hour. Jeffrey, Tony, Alice and Lisa, thank you all for coming on 7-7 for ABC Melbourne, ABC Victoria. It's coming up to the news at noon.